Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It is easy to leave a burning building when it is on fire. But what if that building contains the very thing that gives you life, excitement, peace, joy, courage, and wonder? Will you be an agent of change, or do nothing and eventually leave? If you work in Catholic ministry, business, or education, and need quality content on your website or social media pages, contact The Simple Catholic for copywriting services at thesimplecatholic.blog and click on the writing services page for more information. The Church Militant needs soldiers against the enemy. Enlist The Simple Catholic in this fight for the truth. Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger. Today we have with us Kevin Wells, who's a former sports reporter with the Tampa Tribune, where he covered Major League Baseball and other sports. He's the author of Burst, A Story of God's Grace When Life Falls Apart. He is a freelance writer and evangelist addressing various Catholic topics. Kevin is also president of the Monsignor Thomas Wells Society for Vocations, which financially and prayerfully commits itself to the promotion of strong priests, seminarians, and practicing the fullness of the Catholic faith. His work with youth earned him the James Cardinal Hickey National Figure Award from the Archdiocese of Washington. He lives in Millersville, Maryland, with his wife and three children. In 2009, Kevin survived a close brush with death after a malformed line of vessels in his brain hemorrhaged. The day after invasive brain surgery failed to control the flow of blood that was compressing his brain, Kevin was anointed by Father James Stack, his longtime best friend of his murdered uncle, Monsignor Thomas Wells. To this day, witnesses in that room still tell of the miracle that unfolded at his bedside, and we'll talk about that a little today as well as we cover his book, The Priests We Need to Save the Church. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Pete, thanks so much for having me. It's going to be a great time talking with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. It was an awesome book. It's one that I believe we should get into the hands of many priests and laity. So I guess the place to start is there's two pivotal moments in your life that from reading the book obviously influenced it in your current mission. And the first that I think somewhat jump-started your mission was the murder of your uncle, Monsignor Thomas Wells. Can you tell us a bit about him and what happened on that day?
Sure. Monsignor Thomas Wells was a power in the Archdiocese of Washington for 29 years. He led well over a dozen men to the priesthood. If you lined up 100 priests in a row, he'd be picked out as the most joy-filled and maybe even the funniest. But the thing that made him the power that he was, and I think thousands, not hundreds, but thousands would tell you that he was one of the greatest priests in the history of the diocese, was because he loved the sacramental element of being a priest and a father. He was led to the priesthood because he fell in love with the Eucharist. He figured when he was in college and he started to discern that if he could turn bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ, then he wanted to do it as a priest. So he was led to the priesthood because of the Eucharist, and I think everything flowed out of that. So he was just an enormous power that instigated several conversions to the faith. He just moved people closer to Jesus Christ in the Catholic faith.
Wow! And so what? He was obviously martyred. You tell the story of a homeless man entering the convent, and what happened there? What was the reasoning behind it? Do they know? Was this a random act?
It's actually an unbelievable story. So two nights before my uncle was murdered, my wife and I had visited with him where we had a very meaningful evening. In the middle of the night, on June 8th, 2000, a homeless tree trimmer sort of stumbled out of a bar and broke into his rectory and stabbed him to death in grotesque fashion that the assistant state attorney in Maryland said was the most gruesome murder scene she had seen. I mean, knife wounds sort of marked his entire body, deep plunges, just grotesque. And anyway, what it was discovered years later, not too many years later, but that within that rectory where he was for years, maybe 7-8 years prior, that there was homosexual activity between priests that was going on. Mm-hmm. And two were credibly accused as abusers, two priests that are no longer priests. A third is no longer in the priesthood. He's disappeared. And what was later learned was that the cardinal at that time, Cardinal James Hickey, in the 90s, had asked my uncle to go to his last two parishes to sort of root out, what he suspected was homosexual activity going on in rectories. So I believe, and I think many, many, many others in this area, including a lot of priests, believe that my uncle is no longer alive because of the evil that had taken place inside that rectory at his last parish. Mm.
So we have that as sort of the backdrop to your story. We also have this medical emergency, we'll label it, that you yourself had, that you miraculously healed from, which also involved your uncle. Can you tell us a bit about what exactly happened there and how you were saved, healed?
Sure. One night, about 9 years after my uncle's murder, I laid my head on the pillow for sleep, and a series of blood vessels in my brain sort of exploded. It felt like someone had thrown a tomahawk into the back of my skull. It's called an arteriovenous malformation. It just popped one night, and I was as close to death as one is able. A lot of people die instantly when this sort of aneurysm occurs, but thankfully I was rushed to the hospital, and doctors addressed the brain problem, but they couldn't get the flow of blood to slow down. The blood was drowning my brain. So after 4 or 5 days of unsuccessful angiograms and shunts that were trying to drain the blood unsuccessfully, they decided to perform invasive brain surgery. But even then, they couldn't get to the malformation. It was buried too deep into my cerebellum. So they closed me up, and this was the day that many thought, you know, I was going to die. So thankfully, providentially, my uncle's best friend, Father James Stack, who had just begun a healing ministry earlier that year, was called from his parish in outside of D.C. up to Baltimore. And about an hour later, he came into, and what I'll say is what he told me. He and his healing, sort of his assistant in his healing ministry, came into my ICU room, which was darkened, and I was incapacitated after the surgery. And he said that he knelt down by my bedside and said, "Hey, Kevin, we've been praying the chaplet to Divine Mercy and calling on the Maryland saints on the hour drive up. And is there any saint that we can call on now to help save your life?" And what he said was, he said, "I opened my eyes and I said, I want you to call my uncle down. I need Tommy now." So he stood back up kind of like with sort of a V8 moment and slapped his head and said, "Of course." So he said that he stood at my bedside, actually the top of my bed, and he started to call my uncle and his best friend. And he said, "Hey, Tommy, your nephew Keggy, he needs you now. He asked you to save his life. It's time for you. You got to save his life. You got to ask Jesus to save him." And what he said happened thereafter, and his healing assistant said happened, was lights started to pop all around the darkened room, and the entire temperature of the room changed almost into like a warmth, or almost like when you come in from the winter and you sit by the fire, a real sort of coaxing warmth. And both said they almost fainted, and they knew they said they knew they were standing in the middle of a miracle. He knew what my wife Krista says, that the surgery failed and then nothing else was working. But he knew that that day, that moment, I should say, that everything was going to be healed. And it turned out the next day he was right. They gave me an MRI, and all the fluids and all the blood that was sort of drowning my brain had disappeared. And the malformation, the AVM that was in my brain had also disappeared, and I was going to be well.
Wow. Incredible story. So we have those two events, obviously impactful to you. Is that the catalyst that pushed you to write this book, The Priests We Need to Save the Church, or was there more?
It was. You know, initially, Pete, I was thinking, I was actually very bored in my recovery. I couldn't get out of bed, and I used to be a sports writer, so I just wrote a book that was published a few years after my surgery. It was about God's graces and suffering. But as the years went by, I started to think more about the role of the priest that came from healing. Scripturally, Jesus commands his apostles to heal others. And after what I experienced in that ICU room, I thought more about the power of priests and what they could do. So as the years went by, I sort of wanted to say, you know, Father, it seems to me that a lot of things that I'm sort of seeing Sunday out and maybe at daily mass, and I'm just not seeing the full weight of what the power of the Catholic priest is. And I always wanted to kind of shut it down, because what gives a member of the laity to tell a priest how to be a priest? So mm-hmm. I would say, you can't write that book. But finally, I said, you know what? There's too much strange things going on in the Catholic Church, and really all I'm doing is proposing for what I thirst for. So I began to start writing of what I thirsted for from the Catholic priest.
So you mentioned something there that kind of popped in my mind too when I first started reading this book. Do you still get that pushback? How is a member of the laity going to tell me as a priest how I should be behaving?
Right. Well, it's interesting, Pete. The way it works is you write four or five chapters and you'll send it off to Catholic publishers with sort of a proposal. And last year when I did that, every Catholic publisher said, we don't want your book for that very reason, essentially saying, look, you know, I appreciate it, we get it, but you have no right to tell a priest how to be a priest. And my response was, that's not my intent. It's to tell a priest for what I thirst for. And guess what happens? Guess what happened in June of last year? The Cardinal McCarrick story broke, mm-hmm. or I should say the Mr. McCarrick story broke, and right. the Pennsylvania grand jury report broke, and Bransfield broke, and the Vigano letter broke, and all of a sudden those Catholic publishers started to call me back, and they said, are you still working on that book? So that's when they started to sort of believe what I was writing.
So in the book, and this will be a good way to end this segment, you discuss, and many of us encounter it, people leaving the church either from what they label as boredom or a new lack of trust in the church and her priests. Why do you think people have lost the ability to see the good there is in the church?
I think it's pretty simple. Catholic priests, bishops, have done a very poor job overall the past 60 years demonstrating the fullness of this blazing furnace of truth that we have in the Catholic faith. You know, I count among my friends 8 to 12 very close friends that are Catholic priests. My brother's a priest. I'm from a family of priests. I love and need holy priests. I think overall, though, because we have not done a good job really sort of showcasing the royalty of this faith as maybe Christ intended it to be, or a Blessed Mother would like it to be, that many, many millions of Catholics said, you know what? There's not much here for me. I don't know much about the Eucharist. I don't really know much about mortal sin or encyclicals or catechism or the, you know, so I'm just going to walk away. So a certain degree, I mean, obviously they're not making a wise decision doing that, but they're not fully to blame, because I just don't think they've been given a full display of this beautiful Fort Knox of a faith that we have.
Mm. And that's a good place to stop this segment. We'll be right back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. And we'll be covering more of the priests we need to save the church when we come back.
Popular blogger Catherine Whitaker is a Dr. Pepper superfan, Aggie-loving, type A mom of six, with a personality the size of her native Texas. The stressful, premature birth of her fifth child threw her orderly world into chaos and ultimately led her to rethink her priorities. In her new book, Live Big, Love Bigger, Catherine Whitaker shares her journey and challenges you to understand that you too can live a life of authenticity with joy-filled purpose, love, and faith. Her sassy authenticity will make you laugh and cry while encouraging you to be honest about mistakes in every area of your life. Embrace them and find a way to let God redeem it all. Check out Live Big, Love Bigger at Ave Maria Press or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Today we're spending it with Kevin Wells, the author of The Priests We Need to Save the Church. And Kevin, we touched upon it just a bit in the first segment, but the timing of your writing this book is somewhat uncanny. As you mentioned, you began writing it before what many of us call the dark summer of 2018, and with the McCarrick story and the grand jury report out of Pennsylvania. Did that summer change your vision for the book, or did it just solidify your focus?
It solidified it. I think what it enabled me, though, is sort of a platform or sort of a microscopic soapbox to kind of stand on and sort of proclaim a little more boldly what I've discerned really for 25, 30 years. And I'll tell you, Pete, what had happened was I used to cover Major League Baseball down in Florida, but early on as a young sports writer, I was continually shipped to different cities and towns throughout Florida. You know, Winter Haven to Lakeland to Tampa to Clearwater to St. Pete. And what I had noticed way back then was if my temporary parish in the new town, if the pastor was Eucharistic, if he seemed to have a devotion to the Blessed Mother, if he had daily confessions or maybe had embraced sort of asceticism into his life, then that parish was alive. The parish saw light in its eyes, and it was sort of reflected in the parish. But at the next town, if those things were not being done by the priest, or if he had not embraced or absorbed that into his priesthood, then the parish seemed dead. So it was easy. I mean, anyone could figure it out. Any dummy could figure it out. If the priest was alive, the parish was. So So as the years went on, and I moved back to Maryland, my hometown, and I'd sort of seen the same thing in my own diocese. Just sort of a deadness to all the beautiful things that our faith professes, sort of a contraception of the truth. I saw a deadening of the laity, almost like there were Catholics, but they almost seemed like Protestants because the priest wasn't allowing them to understand what 2,000 years of priests have understood. Mm-hmm. The source and summit of our faith is the Eucharist. Mortal sin is serious. There is heaven and hell. It's probably not a bad idea then to ask your family to join you in a family rosary or maybe a weekly holy hour. So really, this has been on my mind for a while because at the end of the day, you know, it's my responsibility to lead my wife and kids to heaven. They have free will, but as a shepherd, as a father, that's my role. And really, I kind of see it symmetrical. The priest, as a father, should want the same of his flock. He's a shepherd, and a shepherd should want to save each of his lambs. And I just didn't sense that was being done.
So I want to pull a quote from the book here where you say, quote, "I wanted to be a sincere appeal for priestly heroism in what often seems a dark age of Catholicism," end quote. I think many forget, especially after the events of last summer, that there are good priests out there fighting the good fight. How do we support them?
There's exceptional priests out there. As a matter of fact, they're having to become even more exceptional because they know times are disillusioning now for the laity. And they know that, as you mentioned, Pete, so many are straying from the flock. They're joining the evangelical church down the street or or the non-denominational, so they need to be stronger. So as far as how to support them, exactly as what your the practical measures that you would sort of be led to do, you would thank them after a beautiful homily or after a liturgically beautifully celebrated mass. You say, hey, Father, I want to help you. How can I help you in your ministry? Do you need your lawn cut at the rectory? Do you need me to lead a men's group? How about an RCIA study? What do you need? Because I have found that these strong priests, they're overworked. They're working 16-hour days because, and this is kind of sad, but it's testament to where we're at. A lot of these solid, holy priests, they're inheriting or they're absorbing strangers from different parishes that are coming to them saying, hey, my son is off the rails, he's on drugs, or my marriage is in trouble, or Father, you don't understand, my daughter, she's on drugs, and I don't know what to do. So the holy priest says, well, I'm glad to help you, but what about your pastor? Well, he says he's too busy right now, or he's unavailable. So we need to find ways to help these holy priests, because they are getting inundated. And let's be honest, these good and holy priests, they rarely say no. So we can step into the breach to help them, and they will always find ways in which we can help them.
And on the flip side of that, you and I both understand that there is a faction of holy good priests out there, but it seems one that can be hard to find, because some of them, because of what happened last summer, have in some aspects gone underground. They're afraid to speak out because they're afraid of what pushback they may get from their brothers. So what do you think about that, and how do we help them, pull them out of that, so to speak?
Well, I don't want to say it's disgraceful, but I'd like to say it's disgraceful. I will say this. A shepherd marks his identity by dying for his flock. A good shepherd, the good shepherd, I should say. Jesus Christ was the good shepherd who died. A priest who abdicates his role to be that shepherd is not obliging, what he did when he lay down, nose and kneecaps to the floor on the day that he was anointed, and he crawled into the skin of Jesus Christ. Essentially, he should have said, I imagine, maybe he thought it, it is now time for me to die, because as Jesus Christ in persona Christi, who died on the cross, who was brutalized, I need to take the hits. I need to take my own mini crucifixion. So if he's afraid to homilize on tough subjects, or if he's sort of acquiesced to the zeitgeist of society, or he's politically correct, he's just not inheriting his role as father. A father protects. A father saves. So I would say, on a practical way, what the lady can do, if they suspect or they sense out that maybe their pastor or their associate has been reluctant, or maybe has been timid or flat-footed in preaching the fullness of the gospel, the fullness of the Catholic faith, then charitably, I think it's our obligation to God, it's our obligation to the parish, and really it's our obligation to Father to say, hey, Father, I see greatness in you. I see holiness in you, but I don't think you're bringing it outside of yourself, and I want to encourage you to do so. And here's a few things that I sense that just aren't right. Would you mind if we engage in a conversation? I do think if it's handled charitably and with love and with care, that Father's conscience might be pricked, and he might say, you know what? I am holding back. Mm-hmm. I am straitjacketing truth, and you know what? That's unacceptable. And there might be change.
Right. We're talking about established priests with that comment and that questioning that we've had here the last couple of minutes. But Scott Hahn tells a story. I heard him tell it twice this summer in two separate talks I was present at, about his two sons who are now in seminary. And they were leaving after a break to return, and Scott stopped them and said, are you sure this is what you want to do? Because of all the things that happened last summer. When I first heard him say that, I was a little taken aback, but it highlights something I think very important. And I think that this generation of seminarians are going to be fantastic, because both of those sons of his said, yeah, Dad, because the church needs strong men to lead us. How can we help this generation of seminarians become what we need them to be?
First of all, Pete, I couldn't agree more. This generation of seminarians, they're intentional. I mean, you know, who wants to join the Catholic Church anymore as a priest? Because we're mocked, we're ridiculed. You know, there's been so much scandal. So you know the ones that are entering, they're heroes. They're men. I mean, they're true men who are willing to die. And I don't say that metaphorically. You know, they will die for the faith because they love the faith. So how can we help them? Now, obviously, you and I know the first thing we can do is pray for them, pray rosaries for priests. Every day, make a litany to the priests. I mean, pray for your future priests and seminarians. As we mentioned sort of off air, is visit seminaries. Talk to seminary rectors. Hey, Father, you know, how can I help your seminarians? What can I do? Can I take them out to lunch? Can I write them letters? Can I give them books? What can I do? So I think it's getting in touch with seminary rectors. It's praying for seminarians. And if they're at your parish maybe for a year of sort of discernment or sabbatical, you know, hang out with them. Invite them over the house for dinner. Pray with them. Just be their friend. Encourage them because all priests and seminarians and good bishops, they need encouragement now.
Absolutely. Now, as you wrote this book and you know, conducted the interviews for it, did you hear anything that surprised you, or was it just more affirmation of everything we've heard the last summer and throughout these months?
I did hear one thing that surprised me. Well, I heard a few things, but the major thing that surprised me is I met a holy priest. He's a mystic. Received a bilocation from Padre Pio in 1959. He was Mother Teresa's spiritual director and confessor for 5 or 6 years. His name is Monsignor John Essef. Many people believe he will be a canonized saint in the church one day. He told me that for years, traveling the country to seminaries in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even 2000s, giving retreats for seminarians and priests, this is mostly, he said that he discerned an enormous strain of homosexuality or effeminacy in seminaries. He was not so much devastated, because after a while, I guess he just kind of accepted it. But what really devastated him is when he brought it to the attention of rectors, many rectors, Monsignor Essef was politely rebuffed and just said, "Well, you know, not mind your own business, but no, we'll handle this internally." So that's when Monsignor Essef determined, "I need to become a Eucharist. I need to become an exorcist because if a seminary is anti-Eucharist, it's anti-prayer and anti-Mary, and engaging in some of the behaviors that it is," he realized that a lot of seminaries were oppressed by the demonic. Now, obviously, there are superb, excellent, holy seminaries throughout the land.
Right.
But he determined and discerned too many seminaries that simply were not. So he's been an exorcist for the past 30 or 40 years, and he actually teaches exorcists how to become exorcists now. So he's a 91-year-old holy priest who really enlightened me to one of the major problems within our church today. Now, I think it's rapidly sort of leaving, but it's still there.
Right. Yeah, it's still there, and we need to root the remainder of it out. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with Kevin Wells. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media.
Are you married? I'd like to suggest that you often return to the fond and true memory of your spouse when you first met and on your wedding day. Well, he or she is still that same lovable person. Perhaps life has presented many challenges you did not expect back then, but you have come through these together. And the providential fire of your tribulations and your love has forged you into the one body you are today. And that is a beautiful thing. Never let anyone or any inferior thing tear you and your spouse asunder. God is one with you. He is love. Your marriage is love. And love endures whatever comes. It does not come to an end. See 1 Corinthians 13. I'm Jim Littleton of FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.